This is CBS, Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. The Islamic Republic of Iran. Reuters is reporting satellite images, commercial satellite images, show working and development and expansion at two facilities associated with Iran's ballistic missile production. What does that mean for the contest with the Islamic Republic in the region, for Moscow depending upon the Islamic Republic for some kind of war fighting, and especially for Israel, now surrounded by the Iranian proxies? I welcome Behram Bentaleblou, a senior fellow for the Foundation for Defense of Democracy, who has written extensively over these last years about the Iranian missile program and other details of the arming of Islam. Behram, a very good evening to you. Expanding the missile facility, is this because of demand? Is this because they're preparing for some new direction, new ambition? Is it just routine? Good evening to you.
Very good evening to you, John. Always a pleasure to be back. You know, the Islamic Republic for almost two decades now has been home to what the U.S. government has called the largest ballistic missile arsenal in the Middle East. And the push and the pull, the various forces on the size, the quantity, and the quality of that arsenal have changed over time. But right now, in a world where the Islamic Republic has an agreement to give drones and potentially ballistic missiles to Russia, in a world where they have fired hundreds of these projectiles at Israel, in a world where every proxy or militia they've created or co-opted in the Middle East is firing Iranian or copies of Iranian or Iranian-inspired projectiles at America or at Israel or at international shipping, the defense industrial base, which they do have and have set up, needs to be working overtime. So this is supply and demand for the Islamic Republic to meet its own ideational, ideological, military needs, meet the ideational and ideological military needs of its proxies, and potentially even to meet the ideational ideological needs of Vladimir Putin. You'll notice I said ideational and ideological rather than defense and security, because these are offensive campaigns being engaged in by the Islamic Republic, its proxies, and of course Putin's Russia.
The drones seem to be a major factor for Iran. Question is, are they making money? Do they sell to everyone? Is there some kind of bazaar going on?
The drones are really the most interesting, because they got a lot less coverage up until the past decade. The same conflict that birthed Iran's interest in ballistic missiles, the Iran-Iraq War, also has the first ever use of Iranian drones. So that's how old this program is. Obviously, there's been many improvements and a lot more copy-paste from foreign technology and illicit procurement and reverse engineering. But in essence, today you have Iran as a major drone power, both for production as well as proliferation. And the area the regime is looking to go into is now the final phase, which is not just free proliferation, but sales. And that's why today you can look and you'll see Iranian drones or Iranian-inspired drones on at least four different continents. That includes right here in our backyard in South America. And then more importantly, you see these drones and the defense industrial manufacturers that produce these drones going to arms expos in places like Iraq, in places like Serbia, in places like Malaysia. So the Islamic Republic reminds me right now of Russia in the 1990s trying to use its arms industry to generate revenue. So whether they're getting paid for it directly or not from the Russians, that's an open question, because there has been reporting about weapons the Russians have given them, intelligence the Russians have given them, deepening economic and political and even nuclear cooperation, as well as gold and cash the Russians have given them. But they could be giving them something else as well that hasn't been reported yet and that we don't know.
The drones, a memory, Behram, and I'm just checking because I've not asked this question before and it's always bothered me. 2004, 5, 6, somewhere in the Iraq conflict when things were going very bad for NATO, there was a drone that crashed in some fashion in Iranian territory. And I remember a photograph and the Islamic Republic boasting about how it had found it and was taking it back. And then sometime after that, maybe the next year, there were photographs of carbon copies of that drone. Is that the origin of the drone program in Iran, that crashed RQ-101 Reaper, whatever it was called?
I think it was the RQ-170 in 2000. 10 or 11, if I'm not mistaken. The year is.
Yeah, that'd be good. It might be later on. I just don't remember the year. War all rushes together. The calendar moves away. So is that the origin?
It's a critical juncture, but there are several critical junctures. I mean, the needs of the Iran-Iraq war, again, so the origins is earlier. So unlike the missile program where the critical juncture and the need is the war, you have the critical juncture coming further because there's a much wider gap from the end of the Iran-Iraq war to when Iran becomes a drone power versus the end of the Iran-Iraq war and when Iran becomes a ballistic missile power. I certainly tend to think the networks that had done the industrial-grade illicit procurement and, sanctions busting related to nuclear and missile also were able to move into military and commercial. And some of that stuff is even less regulated. Now it's becoming even more regulated because the proliferation of drones and drone programs around the world. But that certainly was a critical juncture in the sense that it brought even the word drone, it resurrected it out of the grave and moved it into the context of the U.S.-Iran, Israel-Iran strategic competition.
There's a new president in Iran, Masoud Pezeshkian. And I read the statement from July 8th that Iran will continue to support the, quote, resistance against the, quote, illegitimate Zionist regime. So meet the new boss, same as the old boss. However, are there turns in the road? Because for some important reason, he's being promoted as a reformer. What does that mean?
Well, Masoud Pezeshkian was supported by Iran's ailing reformist faction. And despite the allegation by the regime that about 49% of the population turned out to vote, something that social media and pictures of empty voting stations belie, Iranians actually have boycotted this election, what they've called in Persian Sirke Entekhabati, or the election circus. They, since 2017, 2018, have been chanting reformist principalist, the jig is up. So telling the world that basically that whatever end of this very narrow political spectrum continues to exist, that they are done with this system in its entirety. And what it really means is Pezeshkian is designed to feign that he has a mandate. You know, this is the way the Islamic Republic talks about elections, or shall we say selections. Just a few months back, during the widely boycotted parliamentary elections of March of this year, you had the commander of the IRGC Aerospace Force talking about high turnout as being a force that could fill the magazines of the weapons in Iran's armed forces. So this is the securitized atmosphere in nature of these electoral contests. Pezeshkian, despite having a stylistic change, is here to deliver, in my view, substantive continuity. And through stylistic change, generate meaningful concessions from Iranian interlocutors and Iranian adversaries. And that's where it's not just new boss, just like the old boss. That's just like new reporting and new conventional wisdom in Washington, just like old conventional wisdom.
I have flawed
and more about us than them.
I have learned from you that Pezeshkian is part Kurd and part Azeri. Are either of those identifications significant?
That's right. He is of both stock and indeed does speak both. But in this case, you know, when you look at the Azeri-Persian relationship, that's kind of like a partners in power, if I can borrow the phrase from Robert Dalek's good book on Nixon and Kissinger, that has really made Iran what it is over the past 900 years. The Kurdish part is much more interesting because Mahsa Jina Amini, as you know, was an Iranian Kurd. It was protests in her hometown that were not about separatism, but that were in concert with larger nationwide anti-regime movements that spurned the Women Life Freedom protests of 2022-2023. And so I think someone like Pezeshkian, given his stylistic changes, given this interesting background you mentioned, is here to shatter and break and impede more domestic opposition from forming and coalescing and unifying, as well as to shatter and impede a more robust transatlantic consensus that already exists to deal with Iran's drone and missile and nuclear and other programs, and in the long term, immunize the regime to a max pressure 2.0 if there is a Trump 2.0, or tempt a Biden 2.0 administration with much more of the same, which is indirect or direct nuclear diplomacy that goes nowhere. And just because he has a smile, and just because he may not have the same kind of rhetoric as Saeed Jalili, ultra-hardliner, and just because he seems to be resurrecting some of Zarif's friends and Rouhani's friends and these reformists from their political graves, if you will, doesn't mean that the West needs to totally jump ship and chuck all of its analog assumptions into the water. I think, in fact, now is the time for clarity. Now is the time to wait and watch and not foist these projections that we see in places like the New York Times and the Washington Post onto these Iranian candidates and officials, but let them speak for themselves and not make the mistake of putting words in the mouths of our adversaries like we did with Putin. And we should listen to them. And if we listen, we will see more continuity than change with Pezeshkian, who in this limited time where he is the incumbent and he will be inaugurated this August, he's chosen to work the phones to talk with the likes of Hassan Nasrallah of Lebanese Hezbollah and Vladimir Putin of Russia.
Benham Bentaleb, the senior fellow for the Foundation for the Defense of Democracy. We turn to NATO and the Iranian threat. Israel and the NATO threat and the Iranian threat, the Red Sea and the Iranian threat. When we come back, this is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batch.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.